Hello, I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning into The Record today. Now, I know part of you is still in the sunshine, glowing from yesterday's heat. I get that. I smell like a swimming pool. But this show is worth climbing out and toweling off for. You are going to learn how Seattle's new minimum wage is working out, at least according to a new UW study. I think City Council member Shama Sawant will question that study. We'll find out. Also, late-night TV hosts are not just kidding around. And advertisers seem to like it that way. We're going to take in some TV monologues, so please stay with us. Our first order of business today is President Trump's travel ban, which got a partial victory from the U.S. Supreme Court. Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team is here to talk about that. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
What action did the U.S. Supreme Court take today?
Yeah, the High Court announced that it will take up this case. It's taking up the appeals from Hawaii and from Maryland, and it will hear arguments in October, in the fall. So this is setting up a major review on the scope of presidential power and whether this executive order is constitutional. And just a reminder, this is a ban on foreigners from six majority Muslim countries and all refugees seeking to come here to the U.S. The feds say this is needed to review security processes. So what also happened with the court today is they said that while they are taking up this review, they will allow part of the travel ban to take effect. But there's a big exception to that. Part of the ban will stay blocked, and that refers to people who are applying for visas with clear ties to the U.S., whether they have family ties, school or work ties. Those people cannot be prohibited from coming here. The ban cannot be used against them. That covers a pretty broad group of people. Mm-hmm. But who is still banned? Those are people without those ties, like tourists and also refugees. Those are still people who are banned under this executive order.
Okay, so this new somewhat scaled down version of the travel ban takes effect on Thursday. And who's going to be affected here in Washington state?
Well, for example, I think the most effect will be on people, on families who are trying to sponsor another family member to come here. Say there's a U.S. citizen who wants their parent or their child to come from one of these countries, from Somalia, for example. That's going to where you're going to see the most people potentially affected. But those people that do have family ties will be allowed through.
Right.
So family visas, those are, it's unclear how, what the ties can be. Will it be parent, uncle? A lot of the implication or a lot of the guidelines still haven't been fully detailed yet. We know in Washington state there's about 15,000 people from these six countries. So not a huge amount of people, but they are mostly here in King County. People who are coming on temporary visas for school or for work, there's still a little uncertainty about how quickly those will be processed through. Refugees is really the big hit here. In Washington state this year, we were aiming to take about 3,800 people, 3,800 refugees here into the state. There's still about 1,300 to go on that limit. So most of those people, it looks like for this current 120-day period, will remain blocked.
And what local reaction are we hearing so far to this Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah, we've heard from a few people so far. Governor Inslee sent out a press statement this morning saying that he was happy, pleased that a substantial number of people will still be protected through the Supreme Court's action and that they narrowed this travel ban order. He also reiterated his view that the ban discriminates against certain people for their cultures and religious beliefs. Some immigrant rights groups have put out responses that they're also pleased the Supreme Court's reviewing the travel ban, but also disheartened about the refugees that will be blocked, people who've already been vetted and cleared that are just left in limbo. We're still waiting to hear from our Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, who you may remember was the first one to launch a lawsuit challenging President Trump's executive order. We're hoping to hear from him or from his office at some point today.
And Liz, what about what could happen at SeaTac Airport? We remember the huge protests the first time the travel ban took effect. What do you think we can expect this time at SeaTac?
Well, it's Seattle, so protests anytime, anywhere could happen, right?
Yeah.
But we're not expecting to see that kind of chaos that we saw in January. It was a really quick rollout. Nobody really knew what was happening. It was unclear if green card holders were included in the ban. We now don't know that they are not. So that confusion is not expected again at the airports. Department of Homeland Security has sent out a memo saying they'll provide more details in the coming days about the implementation in consultation with the border people working at the airports and other points of entry. And the port here has said that they're working closely with those federal officials, too, to make sure the rollout goes as smoothly as possible.
So until now, we know federal courts have been striking this travel ban down. President Trump has been getting these defeats. And today, the president called the Supreme Court decision a clear victory for our national security. How clear a victory is this?
Well, overall, we've seen a whole series of legal challenges that have created quite a lengthy setback for President Trump's executive order. The administration was forced to revise this ban, which Trump has called watered down. He's criticized it as being watered down. So it's a split decision today, or a split kind of reaction on today's actions from the Supreme Court. President Trump sees it clearly as a win, but not a complete win by far, and it may be very short-lived. As I said, only part of the travel ban is taking effect. A big part of it is not taking effect. I put that same question about victory to Matt Adams. He's a legal director with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project here in Seattle. It's a nonprofit that's also has a pending lawsuit against the same travel ban. And here's what he said today about the Supreme Court's action.
They've taken the extraordinary step of stopping his travel ban, at least big parts of it, until they're able to weigh in on it. So I don't see how any person who's involved in it can say that's a win for the Trump administration, because in effect, they've already lost part of it even before they've gotten to the arguments. Now, that's only a temporary loss. Certainly, the court's going to weigh in with a final decision later in the fall. But in the immediate future, the Trump administration is being prohibited from giving effect to its policy, at least with respect to large swaths of the immigrant population.
Okay, so finally, Liz, we want to know what's going to happen next with this.
Right. So we know part of the travel ban is taking effect on Thursday. The Supreme Court's taking it up in the fall. And we'll just wait and see details of how this is implemented and rolled out here. I think that's what we'll be watching for in the next few days.
KUOW's Liz Jones from our immigration team telling you about today's U.S. Supreme Court partial victory for President Trump's travel ban. We'll keep following it. Liz, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. The $15 minimum wage campaign that started in SeaTac came to Seattle. Other people are looking at it, too. It's been this groundbreaking movement. Some say a national model. Some say it's Seattle taking progressiveness too far. And this big fight for $15 has gotten some bad publicity today in the form of a new University of Washington study. The researchers found that going to an $11 minimum wage didn't change that much, but then Seattle took it up to $13 an hour.
When Seattle increased its minimum wage to $13 an hour, we are finding evidence that there was a reduction in hours worked by low-wage employees, and the reduction in hours worked by low-wage employees was sufficiently great that it offset the increase in their hourly wages.
That is University of Washington public policy professor Mark Long, one of the study's co-authors. And his findings are giving fodder to some critics who argue that Seattle workers would have been better off overall if the minimum wage had not been raised so high. I talked about this with Ben Castleman. He's chief economics writer for the website 538. He's looked at this study, talked with economists about it. He finds some good news for workers, but also plenty to be concerned about.
You absolutely have winners and losers. If you were a worker who held on to your job and kept your previous hours, then obviously the big boost to the minimum wage probably, you know, brought you more money. And that's absolutely the case for a substantial number of workers, especially workers with a little bit more experience. You know, they're in demand right now and they've seen a benefit. But if you're somebody who's just entering the job market, you know, that requirement that you pay $13 and now $15 an hour seems to have led some employers to decide, you know, not to fill that job or to employ people fewer hours. And so we saw those sort of net out in a way that ends up being negative for workers on average.
Ben, from what I remember of my college economics class, isn't this economics 101?
We know this is tricky because, of course, if you just sort of think back to your basic economics, then if we're going to raise the cost of hiring somebody, we're going to expect to see companies employ fewer people. But we have really not seen the minimum wage work that way historically. There have been decades of research into the minimum wage. And of course, it's complicated and they don't all agree with each other. But sort of the big picture of it has tended to be that modest increases to the minimum wage really don't hurt employment, that companies find other ways of adapting. But we're sort of running an experiment in this country right now where we're pushing minimum wages to previously unprecedented levels, to $10 and $12 and $15 an hour. And we really don't know what the effect of that will be. And this is one of the first studies to really try to get at that question.
And Seattle is not even paying everyone $15 an hour yet as a minimum wage. Are you saying the Seattle fight for 15 has failed in some way?
Well, look, I think that there are some very important caveats here. This is one study. It has not yet been subjected to peer review, although it's certainly been looked at by a number of economists. There are already some critiques being raised about some of the methodological details. So we definitely can't jump too far to any conclusions with this one study. But it is troubling to think that this policy, which was obviously designed to help workers, could conceivably be hurting them. And, you know, from a national perspective, if Seattle, which is obviously a very high-cost city, if it's struggling with a $15 minimum wage, then that does call into question what the effects could be if it starts to spread to other places where cost of living isn't as high.
As you said, Ben, it's just one study. In fact, there was another study out last week from the University of California at Berkeley that I'm sure you know about. It said that the minimum wage has not led to restaurant jobs being cut. How do these two studies work together?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's a fascinating example of how economic research works, right? You have different studies looking at things in a slightly different way and finding somewhat different conclusions. I do think it's important to recognize that study out of Berkeley did look exclusively at restaurants. And what's interesting is this new University of Washington study also looked at restaurants and found no effect on jobs there. So the studies are actually consistent in that sense. They both find no impact on restaurants. But the University of Washington study finds that there are substantial impacts in other industries, in low-wage work overall. And, you know, maybe by focusing so much on restaurants and fast food, we've been missing some of the impacts of the minimum wage in other sectors.
What's different about restaurants?
You know, I think we don't fully know. It is certainly the case that, you know, in a place like Seattle, where the economy is doing well, it may be easier for restaurants to pass on some of those costs to their customers. Whereas if you're a company that's selling nationally, you may have a harder time passing on those costs. And so you may be forced more to have that have an impact on your workers.
You've said, Ben, that in a way we're experimenting with this higher minimum wage up toward 15. A study like this, if it's borne out, how much of a problem is this for the nationwide fight for 15?
You know, I do think it's very important here to recognize again that this is one study. There's going to have to be both scrutiny of this study and efforts to study how the minimum wage is playing out in other cities and in other sectors. So I hope that both sides are sort of able to look at this as an effort to get to a serious answer. And there should be research that goes on. There should be, you know, more questions that are asked. Nobody should take this as the final word. But, you know, we do have this opportunity now, and I think an obligation to study the effects of these policies as they roll out. Because if it is not working, and that's still an if, but if it is not working, then the people who get hurt by this are low-wage workers, are vulnerable people who we're trying to help. And certainly, you know, folks who support the $15 minimum wage movement do so because they want to help workers. If the evidence is that it's not helping them, you know, I hope that's something that they will take into account.
Well, then if, as we're saying, this is a big if a higher minimum wage toward $15 is not helping low-wage workers, what else could society do if we want to help those with the least? And maybe minimum wage is not the only answer.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that anybody who works in this area would say that you need a suite of policies to try to help people. The earned income tax credit is something that gets pointed to by many economists as a pretty effective policy that gives effectively gives money directly to people who are working and not earning very much money. There have been proposals for even more significant changes to the system, so that we give money directly to impoverished people through something sort of known as a universal basic income. And then, of course, there are long range policies about education, about workforce development, to try to make sure that people have the skills they need to succeed in a difficult environment. There's no question that whatever this research and any other research shows about the minimum wage alone was never the solution. And, you know, we need to keep exploring policies that can make a difference.
Ben Castleman is the chief economics writer for the website 538. He wrote an analysis of the University of Washington study. That study finds that a higher minimum wage may be harmful to low-wage workers overall in Seattle. We have tweeted out a link to that study on Twitter, at KUOW. Now, let's get some reaction to that study from a champion of the fight for a $15 minimum wage, Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me.
As you just heard, this University of Washington study finds that the higher wages that workers do get with the new minimum wage law is more than offset by employers cutting back on hours. What do you say to that?
Well, as you said already, Bill, this is not the definitive study, and it has a lot of problems, and I'll mention one of those in a second, but I just wanted to make sure your listeners are well aware that there's a very good study that has come out from the Berkeley labor economists, including Michael Reich, who was talking directly on Skype to the city council this morning, who shows that their study shows that the wage increases that have already been phased in have actually increased pay for workers, meaning, it, in other words, improved the standards of living of workers without causing any negative consequences for jobs. And one of the problems with the UW study
Let me pause you there, council member, because we talked about that with Ben Castleman a moment ago. Our listeners heard us say that the Berkeley study found that that was a good effect in restaurants, but that restaurants are different from other kinds of jobs. What do you say?
Well, if you look at where many of the low-wage jobs, you know, the workers who have directly benefited from the $15 minimum wage as it's being phased in, are in the service sector, in labor-intensive sector, and restaurant industries are, central to that. I mean, the restaurant industry and labor service sector in general have labor costs that have a third of their operating costs. So it does make sense to look at those sectors. And furthermore, one of the big problems with the UW study is that they have excluded what they call multi-site businesses, meaning, you know, any kind of chain restaurant or chain store. But the problem with removing, with excluding these multi-site businesses is that you end up removing 48% of the workers who were paid less than $15 an hour. So it's a study that actually does not look at a big chunk of the data that they should be looking at.
If peer-reviewed studies, and you and I and Ben Castleman a moment ago have said many times it's just one study with some people calling it out for having problems. If peer-reviewed studies were to continue to show an overall effect of losses in jobs and hours that more than made up for the wage gain, if that happened, would you conclude that a $15 minimum wage is too high or just not enough?
Well, look, the only criterion to decide whether a wage is too high or not is a direct question of standard of living. Are you actually able to pay your rent, satisfy all the basic needs of your family, of your children, if you're caring for elderly relatives? Are you able to do that in a sustainable manner? And who in any honest frame of mind could claim that $15 an hour, which hasn't been phased in fully yet, at full-time work would be about... if you're working 40 hours a week for 52 weeks a year, roughly comes out to $30,000 before taxes. Is anybody honest enough to say that that is a lavish wage to fulfill all your needs? And so if that's the criterion, you know, what do you need in order to survive, then absolutely $15 an hour is necessary, but it's not enough. And if you're talking about too much, you know, if you're talking about too high a wage that is bad for society, then let's talk about the wages of CEOs, the overpaid executives who are taking away the lion's share of wealth that is generated by hundreds of thousands of workers going to work every single day. That's what we have to talk about.
One more question on minimum wage, Councilmember Shama Sawant. If employers are cutting hours in Seattle, again, we underline the if, I mean, Seattle being a very booming city, wouldn't you expect the effect to be more dramatic if $15 were minimum wage statewide, including in places that don't have the Seattle boom going on?
Well, in reality, you know, we have already looked at meta studies, meaning studies of studies, and these meta studies have looked at 1,500 different cases of minimum wage increases across time and across geography, and there is absolutely not a single piece of statistical evidence to show that when minimum wages go up, something negative happens in the economy. But I think we have to go to a larger question. The question is, will big business, will this capitalist economy find other ways of striking back at workers who build movements and fight for, even some modest gains, modest reforms of $15 an hour? I have no question in my mind as a socialist that that big business, the big business executives, the bosses, will find other ways of undercutting workers. So really the answer to this question that you're asking is not that we shouldn't fight for 15. We should absolutely fight for 15 everywhere and federally as well, as Bernie Sanders has been saying, but not stop there, but ask deeper fundamental questions about how this economy functions. I mean, just today, the Guardian newspaper is reporting that the central banks of the world are predicting possibilities of a new financial crash because of another round of risky bank lending. I mean, in reality, our standards of living are extremely precarious as working people. The vast majority of people in the world have precarious standards of living, not because we fought for minimum wage increases, but because that is the nature of the capitalist economy. So we need to keep fighting for 15 like we're doing in Minneapolis right now, and 15 now is winning in Minneapolis with a socialist candidate for city council, Ginger Jensen, leading the way. We have to keep that fight on, but we also have to go deeper than that and really address the problems of capitalism itself.
Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant reacting to a new University of Washington study finding that Seattle's rising minimum wage may be having a negative effect overall on low-wage workers. The council member disputes those findings. One more question on a different subject. The Seattle City Council is holding an event about the fatal shooting of Charlena Lyles. I see. What's going on?
Yes, as your listeners have probably heard, there was this absolutely horrific shooting and death of Charlena Lyles, a 30-year-old pregnant black woman, in front of her children at the hands of the Seattle Police Department. And when I spoke at the rally where there were 500 to 600 people there last Tuesday, I demanded, and the community demanded with me, that the Seattle City Council should hold a public hearing where SPD Chief, Seattle Police Chief O'Toole, could directly answer questions from the community, from Charlena's family. And the fact that the City Council is now holding a hearing tomorrow, which is 6 p.m. at UW-Kane Hall, is a victory for the movement, but Chief O'Toole will not be there. We're demanding that the Seattle Police answer to this directly, but more than that, we're demanding that the City Council and the mayor appoint an independent community-based investigating team to investigate this, because we have seen that nationwide, including the Seattle Police Department, over 1,100 killings happened at the hands of the police last year alone. Only 13 police officers were charged and none were convicted. Just 2 days before Charlena died, Philando Castile, who was killed in Minneapolis at the hands of the police, his killer was acquitted. So I think we need to do that. I've put out a petition. The petition is available on my council website. Already 1,158 people have signed. The petition is demanding an independent community-based investigation.
So that public hearing, 6 o'clock tomorrow, is where?
At the University of Washington's Kane Hall.
Kane Hall, 6 o'clock tomorrow, a public hearing regarding that shooting 8 days ago now of Charlena Lyles. And we've been talking with Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant. Thank you for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we were just speaking of this shooting, the fatal shooting by Seattle police that happened 8 days ago. You know, there was a similar shooting that happened in Seattle last fall on the day when the homeless camp called the Jungle was shut down. Remember that? Police shot a man named Michael Taylor. He was also a person of color. He, like Charlena Lyles, were allegedly both holding knives. And in both cases, officers had a warning that mental health issues might complicate the encounter that they were about to have. Here's more from KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols.
This is a story about how mental illness can complicate police de-escalation. We're going to go back in time to the day Seattle police shut down the Jungle. Lots of people were stressed out. Social worker Michael Volse was there, pleading with police officers to bring in crisis counselors. Later, Volse, who prefers the pronoun they, told me what they said to police.
It seems that you're very ill-equipped to handle this situation.
Volse was concerned because many of the people being forced out of the Jungle struggled with mental illness and addiction. Volse said they told Sergeant Heidi Tuttle, the officer in charge,
these people are in crisis, and so you need to have some crisis workers out here to help them. She said, we've got it under control. I've got crisis workers on standby, is what she said.
So everybody was on edge, and there were teams of police and teams of Union Gospel Mission workers basically operating separately to help people. KUOW producer Ann Kane and I were walking through the jungle on a dirt trail, observing all of this. And we came to this part of the path where there wasn't anybody else around. These two guys started walking towards us. They stopped right in front of us, taking up the whole width of the trail. One of them threatened us, told us he'd mess us up if we didn't give him $10 right now. I pulled out the money.
I should ask for 100.
And then he seemed to have second thoughts, and he tried to give it back.
Give your money back. I'll give you your money back.
But we just walked on.
Hey, I give your money back. Please.
Okay.
I need that robbery. No, please.
The encounter passed so quickly, we didn't take the time to dissect what was happening. We just wanted out of there. Through all this, the second guy pretty much stayed out of it. That guy was Michael Taylor. An hour later, he sought us out. We were standing right by a group of police officers at one of the entrances to the jungle, but he walked right up to us. He was a little hard to understand, so he had to repeat himself a few times. But I understood his message. I apologize. That guy I was with was out of control. I'm not like that. I don't do things like that to people. At the time, I found it strange that he'd sought me out to apologize an hour after he'd watched a guy take my money. But later, I read this remembrance his father shared with the South Seattle Emerald about how Michael Taylor had suffered from delayed response syndrome. It's a condition that rendered him unable to make good split-second decisions. 35 minutes after he apologized to me, the police found him with a knife in his hand facing another man. They shot him.
You know, we're called to a scene that is in chaos, and it's critical that we make a split-second decision to keep everybody safe right there.
That's Joe Winters. He trains police officers in de-escalation at the police academy just south of Seattle. They call it crisis intervention training. Winters trains officers over and over again so that when they encounter a crisis out in the world, they don't have to think. They just know what to do.
So if I came on scene where an individual had a knife, I would be like, drop the knife now. And then once I realized I got his attention, I'd be like, okay, now this is what we're going to do. You're going to put the knife on the ground slowly. You're going to turn around and put your hands behind your back. And as you can see, I'm still having that authority, but I'm not screaming at him. I'm not yelling. I'm not adding to that chaos and keeping it just, you know, whirling around like a tornado.
Winters says social workers and scientists have worked really hard to make this de-escalation technique more effective.
We have come so far. You know, years back, we resorted to yelling at people. And as they got louder, we got louder.
There's this moment in the police report obtained by the Seattle Times when Sergeant Heidi Tuttle shouted at Michael Taylor and then had to assess his response. Taylor can be hard to understand. Tuttle interpreted Taylor's words as something about refusing to put the knife down. Taylor can take time to react, and Tuttle read his expression as fearlessness. When Taylor looked from one officer to the other, Tuttle thought he was assessing which one he wanted to lunge towards. The man Taylor was fighting with said Taylor took a few steps towards the police officers. When that happens, when an officer commands somebody to drop their weapon and they don't do it,
we may have to go to lethal force.
I pushed trainer Joe Winters on this. Why can't you just shoot somebody in the leg? Why do you have to shoot to kill?
Have you ever fired a weapon?
No.
Okay, have you ever handled a pistol or a rifle before?
No.
Okay. It can be a very difficult thing to handle a pistol and be able to hit your target in a split-second decision. We do a lot of firearms training. You're taught just to hit center mass. On a split-second decision, trying to aim for an arm, you can probably think that you may miss. You know, we're not sharpshooters.
Winters says there's always a temptation to second-guess the decisions officers make. He advises,
trust that our officers and deputies are being trained well to go out there and assess split-second decisions and make the appropriate decision for a good outcome.
Here's another similarity between Charlena Lyles' shooting and Michael Taylor's shooting. In neither case could we describe the outcome as good. Remember how the social worker, Michael Vols, recalled pleading with Sergeant Tuttle, the officer in charge, to send in crisis workers? That same officer shot Michael Taylor. Vols was furious inside.
I was just talking to you. I was standing right there hours earlier, and then you shot and killed somebody after brushing me off.
But Vols says we can't blame everything on the police because we don't spend money on mental health or addiction like we need to. Then we ask officers to pick up the slack.
They are being trained to shoot to kill. They're being trained to talk people down. They're like suicide. What the hell do we want them to do? You know, they can't be everything.
One more thing about cases like Michael Taylor and Charlena Lyles. Sometimes it takes a long time to get closure. 8 months have passed since Michael Taylor was shot. The inquest into his shooting begins Tuesday. I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now let's stay on the topic of the shooting of Charlena Lyles. This happened yesterday at the Pride Parade in downtown Seattle.
I see why you're here. And also, this parade shall continue, right? Yeah. Right? We can talk in the future about how to best do this. But it's happening now, so we're going to deal with it now. Yeah? I'm going to say, we will have a 30-second moment of silence from here to there to honor Charlena Lyles and her life. Are you okay with that, people?
Yes.
30-second moment of silence? I need to hear yes.
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 Yes. Yes.
Honor.
A 30-second moment of silence for Charlena Lyles at yesterday's Pride Parade in downtown Seattle. But it was more than a moment. A group of about 40 people sat down in the street, and overall, the Pride Parade was delayed for about 30 minutes. And with us in the studio are two of those people, Lori Roselio Torres and DJ Martinez. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Bill.
Why did you block the parade?
Well, personally, as a Two-Spirit Indigenous person, I just felt that it was a slap in the face to have a Pride Parade that's sponsored by Wells Fargo and other banks that, are clearly contributing to ongoing genocide of Indigenous peoples. And Seattle being a city that's divested from Wells Fargo, it just seemed totally tone deaf for Pride to go ahead and do that. And I know that the Pride Parade invited the Northwest Two-Spirit Society contingent to lead the parade, which felt kind of like an invitation to include indigeneity. But the contingent actually ended up getting pushed back at the parade yesterday. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, so it was about Indigenous people, about Wells Fargo sponsorship. And Lori, what about you?
Sure. So the folks who blocked the intersection were actually a multiracial contingent that came together to recognize all the ways in which Pride, while it's a beautiful celebration for many people and helps like raise visibility for LGBTQ issues, it's also at many times very homogeneous and doesn't recognize the multidimensional facets of who we are. So we were.
Why do you think that is, that homogeneity in Seattle Pride?
Sure. Well, it relates back to the presence and existence and continuity of white supremacy and white privilege in the U.S. And although Seattle is an incredibly progressive city in many ways, it's still subject to that systemic issue of how white privilege plays out. And again, we were multiracial and we were all queer and trans people of color in that group. I also want to recognize that at this moment, I am a Filipino queer person with an Indigenous Two-Spirit person, and there is not a Black person of color with us, and they are often at the forefront of the most violence. Let's tie it back to Charlena Lyles. Black women, Black trans women are subjected to and disproportionately impacted by violence on systemic levels, violence by police, violence at the hands of poverty, violence in the workplace. And they are often doing the most amount of work to try to care for those communities that are overlooked and targeted by police.
Are you saying that the LGBTQ community in the Seattle area, is it any more or less inclusive than society as a whole? Is there a special problem, do you think, with Seattle Pride?
I actually want to zoom in on your use of the term inclusive. So when you talk about inclusion, right, that's this idea of like, oh, everybody is welcome. But for us, we recognize that for generations, like the history of this country's founding is on oppression. And so it's not that like we're against everyone, right? We recognize that harm has been done to communities, especially Indigenous and Black communities. So it's not, we are being very specific in like inclusion isn't enough. Inclusion says you are allowing the same people with the power to harm us in the same space as the people who've been harmed historically. And we are trying to protect that space for people and uplift their voices and their power.
DJ, I've heard it said that some people think Pride has lost its edge, that it has. You mentioned Wells Fargo. There are corporate sponsors. On the other hand, the Pride Parade sure has caught on. You've got hundreds of thousands of people coming downtown to celebrate. What's the Pride Parade of your hopes?
Well, I mean, a Pride Parade, I would hope we would be celebrating. I mean, it's just hard. The thing for me is that it's a disconnect. How can we celebrate when people are being murdered? How can we celebrate when people are getting assaulted on Capitol Hill and people are watching and not doing anything? These reports come out all the time. And so there's a real big disconnect. And I think it's important for us to highlight that and sort of make people recognize that not everyone can be there.
So you think it's not time for a parade? You're saying why are we celebrating?
I think it's time for us to come together and sort of be on the same page and sort of have compassion and empathy and sort of just, it's a time to heal. This is a hard year. It's a hard time in America right now, all over the world. But this is especially a strange time for us, and it's time for us to sort of get that collective consciousness under control and just be on the same page and sort of have empathy and understand a better understanding. Instead of saying, why are you doing this? You shouldn't be doing this. Say, why are you doing this? And listen and sort of, you know, have a conversation and a dialogue.
Did people tell you you shouldn't be doing what you were doing?
Absolutely.
Also, I want to interject real quickly. We want to give a clear and kind reminder that Pride was not a parade to start with. It started as a riot back at the Stonewall riots because of Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, trans women of color. It wasn't always white. It wasn't always balloons and glitter. It was actually a very real fight because the safety of people of color and queer folks was at risk and continues to be, especially for young people of color. Washington is in the top 5 states for youth incarceration and number 1 for jailing non-youth criminal folks. And 20% of the youth suicides are of Native and Black folks here in Washington.
So you think the balloons and glitter sends the wrong message? You'd like to take that out of...
No, not at all. I think there's room for complexity. Mm-hmm. There's room for all of us. And I think in addition to the balloons and glitter, let's think about what we want to put balloons and glitter for. Why not fund public education? Why not have healthcare that is accessible? Why not have immigration laws that uplift like the refugees who are fleeing to have liberation here and enjoy the rights in the U.S.? Why not celebrate workers' rights? You know, all of these things are possible. We're just saying it's not just one thing. We're saying, like, let's have a bigger celebration that recognizes these things that we're still working towards.
What did you think of, finally, the symbol in Philadelphia that maybe a lot of our listeners have seen, the brown and black stripe added to the rainbow flag? What did you think? And has that gotten any pushback in Seattle?
It's the most beautiful thing we've seen this year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Has it been widely adopted in Seattle? I haven't seen it like I've seen it, you know, in Philly.
I can't speak to that, but what I can speak to is the reception of recognizing Black and Brown on top of that beautiful rainbow pride finally kind of showcases the fact that, like, the ability for people to celebrate and indulge in this rainbow, like, festival was built on the labor of Black and Brown folks. And like, I think it's beautiful and powerful that Black and Brown is at that top of that rainbow when we've been at the bottom of everything. Like, you know, all this celebration was built literally on our backs.
Lori Roselio Torres and DJ Martinez talking about what happened at the Pride Parade yesterday in Seattle. A group of people sitting down, calling for a moment of silence for Charlena Lyles and and putting a pause in that parade. Thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We invited Seattle Pride to also come and talk with us, the Pride organization, and we haven't gotten a response yet. That invitation stands, so give us a call. We'll continue this conversation, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. More of KUOW's The Record in just a moment. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A few months ago, the Seattle Police Department started a new kind of community outreach. Police would play video games online and chat with the people who were watching them play. This was considered a PR triumph until it wasn't. Here to tell you that story from Seattle's tech news site GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Bill.
For people who don't know about this, what is an online video game streaming service like what the police were using?
So in this case, they were using Twitch. There are others. For example, Microsoft owns one, but Twitch is the dominant game streaming service. The whole idea is that people go online, play video games. Other people watch them play the games, watch them in their living rooms as they do it in a little picture-in-picture shot, and then chat with them along the way. And to somebody who's not immersed in video games, it can sound nuts.
Right. The idea of watching someone else play a video game.
But it's a very social experience, and it's very popular. Twitch has 9.7 million daily active users. There's about an average of 106 minutes watched per person per day. 106 minutes. I mean, there are broadcast TV networks that would kill for that kind of engagement. So
right.
This is a very popular medium.
You play people playing for an hour and 45 minutes at a time. And the Seattle police were playing this game called Destiny.
That's right. And this is a game. It's a first-person shooter game from Bungie. So this is the same company based over in Bellevue that was originally responsible for the Halo franchise. So you get a sense. It's sort of a sci-fi shooter game.
Mm-hmm. And they take questions while they're playing? How are police interacting with fans while they're playing Destiny?
So the police themselves are talking. They have headsets on. And just like any other video game streamer, they're chatting about the games as they play. And then the people who are watching can chat with them via text, and so then they'll take up any questions that the folks might have as they do it. I've watched a few of these, and it's been very informative and instructive, and really, I think, for many weeks, reached their goal of engaging with the community where it is, wherever it is.
Yeah, they will talk about marijuana legality. They'll talk about immigration, heroin, right? All kinds of public policy issues they're playing.
Exactly. Driving in the snow. I mean, it went from very high-minded issues to some very practical tips that the police department would give out.
Right. So then, while they're playing the game, you describe it as a first-person shooting game.
Yes.
So in this game, Destiny, you're controlling a character that has a gun who can shoot at aliens.
Aliens, yes.
Yes.
So aliens. Now, in the situation we're talking about, which was the Sunday shooting of Charlena Lyles, they actually, the officer who did this, was very specific not to run around shooting during the discussion of this particular incident. And
yes.
I got to watch the whole thing. And it was very measured, very careful. But in the context of the broader situation surrounding this shooting, and without the context of everything they'd been doing in the weeks leading up to this, it struck people, and in some cases justifiably so, as tone deaf.
To help people picture this, here is the sound of Sergeant Sean Whitcomb discussing the Charlena Lyles investigation. On the screen, you're seeing Whitcomb's character just standing there, as you say, not shooting, just looking into the distance as the airplanes come and go.
The investigation is in full swing. We are underway with interviews. Our CSI team has collected evidence, has processed the apartment, and there's information that we'll be releasing in the coming days.
Very calm and peaceful, right? Except the character is wearing an enormous kind of blaster gun on his back that he would normally use to be shooting aliens.
That's right. And I think this, as you're saying, in the context for somebody just coming to this fresh, it's shocking. And,
yeah.
And the police department actually ended up taking their Twitch channel down, taking this video down specifically from Twitch and YouTube. And they said that it was never done maliciously or with a cause to hurt. Our reporter, Kurt Schlosser, interviewed the police officer who was involved in this in the Twitch broadcast. And they basically said this was just an extension of what we were doing previously. But you can understand where the reaction was as it was.
Yeah, weren't the police saying essentially it would have been weird or come off stilted to suddenly stop doing the community outreach they were doing just because there's an investigation into a fatal shooting?
That's exactly what they said. And it makes a lot of sense to the community that had been following them. Now, one important thing to point out is they did not have a giant audience for their Twitch stream. You know, they had a few hundred on YouTube, you know, and Twitch combined. And so this was not something where they had a giant audience that they needed to satisfy. But in the context of what they've been doing, it felt natural to them to just continue the conversation they'd been having.
Do you know why the police would choose a shooter game? I mean, are there other games that you can play on these streaming services that aren't have nothing to do with shooting?
Absolutely. For example, and I was looking at this, anticipating, you know, what else they could play. They could have chosen Minecraft.
Yeah.
That is one game you could stream.
It's where you build stuff, basically.
Exactly. The demographic on Minecraft and Destiny is very different. And the other thing is, I'm sure these police officers have certain video game skills. And we actually profiled this department that's doing this, the public affairs department that's doing this. And clearly, they were passionate about Destiny.
Right.
So that said, that demographic in terms of that age group is one that would probably be a great one to reach, you know, 18, 24, 30. Versus you're going to get into some teens and preteens if you start streaming Minecraft and talking about police issues.
Yeah, you can reach older people. I guess the question is what are you trying to say to them? I mean, you could argue they're sending a message that, well, apparently Seattle police officers like to simulate shooting at an alien, someone who's not one of them. And that seems like not an ideal message. It seems like, in retrospect anyway, looking at it now.
Absolutely. And that is certainly the message that someone could take as the subtext. One important point to note, when they originally started this months ago, this was actually run up the flagpole, and the police chief and the mayor both at least knew about it, if not signed off on it. So this was not something that was done by a rogue squadron in the department. This was something that was done with at least a little bit of oversight.
I don't know if you can answer this, Todd, but I'm wondering, maybe it's because I'm of a certain age or something. I mean, shooter games have been around a long time, sure. I certainly know, but I wonder if the audience for shooter games and doing this, sharing it, doing it online and chatting with people has gotten so mainstreamed that somehow it's the message to most people is not as violent as you might take it if you're not into this world?
That is, I believe, the classic argument about the way video games can desensitize you to what's going on around you. And I don't have the answer to that, mm-hmm. but I do think that's a very important question to bring up. You know, in basically proceeding on this platform and picking this game in particular, why weren't the officers thinking about this potential outcome? And I think it's an important question to ask.
Okay, so the Seattle Police Department has suspended its use of this channel forever, temporarily? We don't know?
For now, at least. I think mm-hmm. it's probably unlikely that it would come back in the same form, at least in the short run, given the controversy that it caused. And you know, but hopefully this does not prevent them from experimenting with other media to reach populations that would otherwise not hear from them.
Are there other kinds of media and new platforms that maybe we haven't heard about that where it's the new Twitch? You know, there's this has arisen and this has arisen, and these are places where people are spending their time and can be reached as a non-traditional, non-KOW maybe listening
yep.
audience.
Absolutely. Snapchat, WhatsApp, a lot of messaging platforms. You know, frankly, the Seattle Police Department has done a great job on Twitter as well and has won kudos for their ability to engage in a respectful yet funny and in an entertaining way at times.
Right.
So there's lots of different media out there for them to try. I think they should be commended for giving something new a shot, even if in the end it wasn't the right thing for some audiences out there and could justifiably be described as a bit tone deaf.
We've been talking about this with the co-founder of Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire, Todd Bishop, telling you why the Seattle Police has, at least for now, suspended its use of Twitch, and their channel was called Fuzzfeed 206.
That's right. And Twitch, by the way, we should say, is owned by Amazon. Amazon acquired this for about $970 million a few years ago. So lots of Seattle area connections here on these games.
So again, if you're new to that, to Twitch, it's legit. Amazon paying $1 billion-ish for it.
That's right.
Right. Just new to you, perhaps. Or maybe not. Todd Bishop, thanks for filling us in.
Thanks, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record, back in just a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I began this show by saying a part of you is probably still in the sunshine. We're still glowing a little bit from the hot weekend. Let me end with a little story of it's a cool-off in an amazing way. An Orcas Island man has become the first person to complete the race to Alaska on a stand-up paddleboard. He stroked 750 miles solo from Port Townsend up the Inside Passage, crossing the finish line last night in Ketchikan, Alaska. Here's a short little story about him from reporter Tom Bonsi.
A crowd came down to the harbor in Ketchikan to see Carl Kruger complete an athletic feat that quite a few people had called crazy, nutty, and foolhardy. The exhausted and soft-spoken 45-year-old glided to the dock, stepped off his 17-foot stand-up paddleboard, and rung the finisher's bell. Then Kruger embraced his waiting wife and daughter and expressed amazement at what he'd done over the past 2 weeks.
There were days where every single stroke was a barrier. I just wanted to stop. Everything was screaming at me to stop. So it was absolutely mental, absolutely.
Kruger maintained an incredible pace on his journey north. He averaged about 50 miles per day on his stand-up paddleboard. Two other paddleboarders from Northwest Washington dropped out of the race to Alaska after 1 week. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
750 miles solo on a paddleboard. Try that this weekend. And thanks for tuning in on KUOW's The Record.